Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and it is open forum today. 2 hours of open forum with two fantastic open forum guests to take your calls. Open forum means any question that you have about us Catholics, we'd love to try to answer it for you. You can be Catholic and call. You can be not Catholic and call. Anyone's welcome to call. And we will do our very best to get you the best answer we can. 888-318-7884 is our number. 888-318-7884. Our guest next hour will be Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. And this hour, we're joined by Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of many things, including The Fathers Know Best, Your Essential Guide to the Teachings of the Early Church, with foreword by Marcus Grodi, and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy. How you doing?
I am very well. How are you?
I am well also.
We did a little pre-show and ate some candy.
Yeah, we did.
So some candy
from our childhood.
We might be fired up because of the sugar.
Sure.
Well, you're not a big sugar eater now, are
no,
you?
No, I'm not. I very rarely eat sugar.
You're gonna
be okay? It was a childhood memory that I wanted to experience and share with you.
So. I had never had cherry mash before.
Yeah.
And it's very, very good.
And so, I hadn't had a zero bar in ages. So
yeah, so you can always join us when we're doing the pre-shows. We don't always do them, but when we're doing them, it's usually 15 minutes before the show on Facebook, YouTube, and Periscope. Hello to everyone who is joining us on Facebook, YouTube, and Periscope, or any other streaming service. And hello to all of you. Again, I will repeat, any question that you have about the Catholic faith, we are happy to try our very best to get you the best answer we can. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, since I have your book, The Fathers Know Best, in my hands, I wonder if you could tell me a father of the church. Well, first of all, the fathers of the church are
old dead
theologians,
guys.
Old dead guys. Yes, and also, old dead guys. So I don't know where I was going.
They're more than that.
Yeah, they
are that.
In addition to many other things.
Yeah.
All right, that's where I wanted to go. Why are they important? Why do we care what they say?
They're important because they lived in the early centuries of the Christian age, and they therefore serve as one of the links between the New Testament age and our age.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are bearers of the tradition
mm-hmm.
that comes down to us from Jesus and the apostles. They're tradents of that tradition. And because they're early, they are closer to the source of the tradition than later links in the chain. And that has pluses and minuses. On the plus side, you know, they had some additional access to memories of things that hadn't yet been lost. On the minus side, they lived in an age before the doctrinal development that later occurred,
right.
took place. So they aren't always as precise. So there's kind of a trade-off there. But they are privileged and important bearers of the deposit of faith that comes from Christ and the apostles.
Now, is it true that Cyril of Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
is the best one of all of them? Is that I have heard that rumor.
That would be a purely subjective assessment. That would
okay.
be up to the individual to make a decision on.
All right, I had heard that. I don't know where I heard it, but I heard it. But okay, so let's say
Cyril of Jerusalem actually had a few problems on a few things, but still on the side of the angels.
Okay,
I love in his catechetical lectures.
Yeah,
because he's famous for a set of lectures he did. It's kind of the ancient equivalent of an RCIA program. And he's doing it right there in Jerusalem. He's like, this is around the year 348 AD.
Yeah.
And he's doing it right there in Jerusalem. So it's a new, the religion of Christianity is now tolerated here. There are all these churches going up. There's a lot of people who are catechumens that are coming into the faith. And he's talking to them, and during the course of his lectures, he'll like point at the holy sites.
Uh-huh.
Because you can
there it is.
Point at the tomb of Jesus where that was.
Wow.
And he's also very, very frank with the catechumens he's talking to. Like at the beginning of his lectures, he's saying, you know, I don't know what brought you here. And he names a bunch of things about why people may have come, including there may be a cute Christian girl you're interested in.
Oh, he mentions that.
He does. But he says, whatever brought you here, it's not enough to become a Christian. You need to have sincere Christian faith. And that's what we're going to be teaching you.
I like Cyril. I'm glad to hear that.
I'm very surprised by that.
That I would
Cyril
like
Cyril Kelly.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if anyone called him Cy. I wonder if that ever happened.
People in the past knew how to abbreviate.
They did. Yeah,
they gave many nicknames.
So you know what? When you said that though, 348 A.D., there's Cyril teaching in Jerusalem, and it would still be hundreds of years more that Christians would be in Jerusalem before the Muslim presence would kind of.
That's the 600s.
I don't know. I guess we forget about that, about how – I mean from the time of Christ up to the 600s that Christians are there. And in many cases, Jews are still there.
Well, there was some interruption there because what happened was – so you know everybody pretty much or a lot of people know about the Jewish war that happened in the AD 60s that led up to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And after that, they reconstituted and continued as Roman vassals. But then there was another rebellion called the Kaidos Rebellion that kind of occurred in different places. But then in the AD 130s, between 132 and 135, there was a second great rebellion led by a man named Simeon Bar Kokhba.
Yeah.
And they kicked out the Romans, but then the Romans came right back in and stomped them. And this time they said, okay, we've had enough of this from y'all. And so all Jews are banished from Jerusalem.
Right, right.
And they kicked them out and they renamed it Aelia Capitolina. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't called Jerusalem. Jews were not allowed there. Christians were allowed there. But this caused a break in the Jerusalem church, or a shift, I should say, in the Jerusalem church, because up to that point, all of the bishops of Jerusalem had been Jewish.
Oh.
And then when Jewish people were kicked out of Jerusalem, you had the first Gentile Christian bishop in Jerusalem. And we even know the names of those original Jewish bishops. And surprisingly, after James the Just, it looks like none of them reigned for very long. They had very short reigns because there were a bunch of them.
Oh, so they were either very elderly or the political
or
situation.
Yeah.
Right. 888-318-7884, our number, open forum. As our topic, that means anything you'd like to know. Let's go to Damien in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Damien, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, guys. As if to perfectly segue off of the Church Fathers conversation, my Greek interlinear Bible says in Luke that Gabriel approached a virgin, and the word for virgin is Parthenon. Now, that's also a temple in Greece. Or in Athens, dedicated to Athena. I was hoping you could just embellish a little bit for me, please, on the use of that word and its Greek context. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, they're different words. They are related. The word for virgin is parthenē, for a female virgin. That's what's known as its lexical form or its dictionary form. The way Greek works, there are different endings that a noun takes depending on the function it's playing in a sentence. So it'll have a different ending if it's the subject of a sentence or if it's the direct object or what have you. And I'd have to look at the Greek text of Luke, which I don't have in front of me, to see exactly what the ending on it is there. But the underlying word is parthenē. And if it were a male virgin, it would be parthenos. And that ending, the shift between os and a, tells you what gender. Kind of like in Spanish, you'll have certain words that when they're used of a man, like abuelo, grandfather, the o on the end tells you it's a man, whereas abuela, the a tells you it's female, so it's grandmother. And Greek works like that too. In terms of the Parthenon, I haven't recently looked up its etymology, So I don't have that ready to hand. I may be able to look it up quickly during the break. It is related to the word for virgin. Precisely how I would want to check. I don't remember if Athena was regarded as being a virgin goddess or not in Greek mythology. But tell you what, I'll check during the break and see what I can come up with.
Hang on, Damien. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible, or did Protestants remove seven books from the Old Testament? In Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, author Gary Machuda takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information, discourse on crucial issues, and a topical index, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Luke 12:49, Jesus stated that he had come for division. In a household of five, three will be against two, sons against fathers, and mothers against daughters, and in-laws against in-laws. He speaks of his passion as a baptism and how it anguished him. The division he spoke of is the result of evil in the world. One cannot accommodate evil and at the same time be faithful to him. One must choose. Nowhere do we see this more blatantly played out than in the abortion problem and other moral situations where Catholics don't want to take sides for fear of losing an election or the approval of others or of just not wanting to bother. His passion was far more than just a bother. He was motivated by his love and concern for us. What is our motivation? Do we place ourselves first or him first? I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. When we last spoke, we were talking with Damien in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers app. And Jimmy, you had you promised a follow-up for Damien.
Yeah. So during the break, I looked up the reference, the etymology of Parthenon, and it doesn't appear to be because Athena was a virgin goddess. It's the other thing I suspected but didn't mention, which is there were unmarried women who were presumed to be virgins who were housed there.
Oh.
And so according to Wikipedia, the origin of the Parthenon's name is found in the Greek word parthenon, which referred to the unmarried women's apartments in a house, and in the Parthenon's case seems to have been used at first only for a particular room of the temple. It is debated which room this is and how the room acquired its name. The Little Scott Jones English Greek Lexicon states that this room was the western cella of the Parthenon, blah, blah, blah. And it looks like there were some young girls who were chosen to serve Athena every year. Also, I was able to get the Greek text of Luke because our caller had said that in when he looked at the Greek text, it had the same word Parthenon there in Greek. And this is a little subtle because in Greek there's two different sounds for O. There's omega or big O, and omicron or little O.
Okay.
And omega is pronounced like a long O in English, Parthenon.
Known. Okay.
That's the temple one. But here in Luke, it's Parthenon with omicron, with little O. And so it looks the same in transliteration, but it's actually a different vowel and it's a different word, but they're very similar. We mentioned Parthenē is the root form of the word, but here it has the on ending because of the role it's playing in the sentence. It's the object of a preposition, and prepositions frequently force the word they're modifying into a specific to have a specific ending.
Damien, does that settle it for you?
That is awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Damien. It is open forum. Any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, we're happy to take. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, addressing your questions. We go now to Kyle in San Antonio, Texas, listening also on the Catholic Answers app. Kyle, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si. I was listening a couple days ago to Tim Staples' talk, and he had a question that he answered that basically was, you know, in light of some of the Holy Father's statements on the death penalty, specifically his phrase that it is in itself contrary to the gospel, does that mean that there's going to be a change in church teaching on the death penalty? And Tim's answer was basically no, because the Pope wouldn't have the authority to declare that the death penalty is an intrinsically evil act. That even the Pope doesn't have that authority to change that church teaching. But that got me thinking. Let's say a Pope were to come out with a statement that said, like, I infallibly declare the death penalty is intrinsically evil. Who would have the authority to tell the Pope that he doesn't have that authority? And, like, how would that work if he were to come out with a statement like that?
Okay. Well, to answer the question as you put it, nobody would have the authority to tell him, because he wouldn't be wrong. If he infallibly defined that, you know, any proposition like the death penalty is wrong or is always wrong, if he infallibly defined it, then because the Pope has the protection of the Holy Spirit when he's infallibly defining something, then that would turn out to be true. And so nobody would have the authority to correct him, because he would be right. So so that's answering the question as you put it. To take a step back and get at some of the principles, now I have to say I didn't hear this program that Tim was on, and I haven't talked to Tim about this. So I have to acknowledge that there may be something lost in the translation, and I'm not commenting on what Tim said. I'm commenting on what you said. I would say that there are people who are of the opinion that it has been infallibly defined already by the Church that the death penalty is permissible in at least some circumstances. There's a book out, and I think we've had the authors on the show, Edward Fazer and Joseph Bissett.
We had Dr. Fazer on.
Yeah, and they're of the opinion that this has been infallibly defined. Others are of the contrary opinion. An example of such a scholar would be Dr. Robert Fastigi of Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit. And I've been doing a review of this issue, and I have to say Fastigi's correct and Fazer and Bissett are wrong. And I am going to, in all likelihood, be doing some writing to explain that. I recognize that this is something on which serious professionals have a difference of opinion, but in point of fact, the Code of Canon Law emphasizes that nothing is to be regarded as infallibly defined unless this is manifestly evident. And if you do a careful study of this question, the conditions needed for infallibility are not manifestly evidently met. And so consequently, I would say that you can make all kinds of arguments that it's true that the death penalty is permissible, but arguing that it's true is not the same thing as saying the Church has infallibly defined that it's true. And so whether or not it's true, the Church hasn't infallibly defined this. To get another step back to look at the principles, it's very unlikely that the Pope would make any kind of infallible declaration on something like this. Infallible declarations are very rare in the life of the Church, especially on direct doctrinal matters like this. And the natural thing would not be for a pope to suddenly say this infallibly, but in a non-infallible way. And that's, in fact, what Pope Francis was talking about. The Catechism has already had the section on the death penalty modified from the original 1992 edition. It was modified later in the 90s after Pope John Paul II addressed the death penalty in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae. And in a recent discussion of the Catechism, Pope Francis suggested it could be modified again in an even more restrictive way. He didn't propose specific language for it to use. That would be something that would need to be reviewed, you know, carefully considered and reviewed by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and receive papal approval. So there'd be a process there that would have the tendency to work out any doctrinal kinks that you know, that might emerge. So I would say, you know, it's something for people to keep in prayer, but it's not something to have anxiety about. Trust the Holy Spirit to guide the church and its pastors. Finally, having said that, you know, if a pope is wrong on something, anybody can point out he's wrong. It's not a canonical authority because there is no the pope is the highest teacher in the church, so nobody has canonical authority to correct the pope. But anybody who's in possession of the truth could, in a respectful way, say, Your Holiness, you know, I think you need to look at this evidence here yeah. because it points in the other direction.
Kyle, thanks very, very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is our number. It is open forum today with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys. Now, my question is, earlier this year, I've come across images on YouTube and the internet, images and videos, that is, of Anglican and Lutheran priests celebrating the Mass ad orientem. And I've been curious since seeing that, was this always a historical practice for them? Did they do it to retain their Catholic heritage? Did the priests simply prefer to do it that way, or all three of the above?
Okay. Now, some in the Anglican Communion may use the word Mass for what they do, but generally that term is not used by most Protestants, including Lutherans. However, they do obviously celebrate the Lord's Supper, and they normally will use language like celebrating the Lord's Supper or something like that to refer to their equivalent of it. To be honest, I don't know the history of how that developed in their traditions. There's been a long-standing tradition to celebrate facing the east, and the way most churches were configured in the Middle Ages, that would they had altars that were up against the eastern wall of the church, and so for much of the liturgy, the priest would be facing east and facing the altar, and thus representing the people by facing the same direction that they were facing. Since these churches, many of them were inherited by Anglicans and Lutherans when the Church of England and when the English government and the German governments imposed the new faith on the lands, they inherited these churches, and so they would have been structured for that kind of facing. And I don't know of an immediate movement to, you know, push the altars away from the eastern wall. So it could well be that this tradition survived for some time and may still survive in these areas simply as a matter of habit without having a particular theological significance. But I'd have to research the question historically to say for sure.
Thank you very much, Ryan, for that call. I hope that was helpful to you. Jimmy, did you know that we're giving you away free? We have a.
I think the 13th Amendment prevents that.
Oh, well, okay, but we're giving your work away free. You gave that. How shall I put it? It was so brilliant. It compared to the work of Cyril of Jerusalem Talk at our recent conference. What the Reformation was all about was the talk. We've got it in MP3 format, and we're giving it away free to anybody who joins our radio club. You just go to catholic.com/radio club. And you sign up, you get your free MP3, and then as a member of the Radio Club, you also get all of the benefits of being a member of the Radio Club, including that we send you a newsletter each week, and we don't bother you with millions and millions of emails. Just go to catholic.com/radioclub and get your free MP3.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
This is apologist Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day. In conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a go-to resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Check out EW10's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin taking your calls this hour on any aspect of the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. Jimmy, you got a new book out. It's called 20 Answers Bible Prophecy.
And here it is right now.
And you have a copy of it.
Walked into the radio studio and there was one here. This is the first copy I've held in my hands. I hadn't seen it before.
So
the title is very descriptive. It has 20 answers on Bible prophecy.
Wow.
So it's no false advertising. You know what you're going to get.
And was it hard to whittle it down to 20? I mean
– Well, no. It was fairly easy actually. What this people may have seen our 20 Answers series, which is a series of short books that are designed to deal with an issue in a concise way, so they're not big, long reads. Today I was reading a book that has – chapter 2 is like 130 pages.
In
this book I'm reading,
chapter.
It's like it's pummeling, you know. But you know, to try to tackle a chapter of that length. But these are much shorter, and so they're a quick read. And we had a need in our schedule for one to be written quickly, so I can write quick, and I volunteered to write one on this subject because I find it fascinating. I mean, Bible prophecy is a subject I've been intrigued by since my childhood, you know, because mm-hmm. I grew up in the 70s with late great planet Earth and nuclear war and all that. And so the first books of the Bible that I actually read were prophetic. And
Because you get like drawn into the book of Revelation.
Exactly, because, and Daniel and so forth.
Right.
And so I've been intrigued by this subject for decades, and loads of people are fascinated by Bible prophecy. One of the things I did in this book that's different than most books on Bible prophecy is I made it, even though it's short, I made it comprehensive. And what I mean by that is most books on Bible prophecy zoom in on the passages they think are in our future. And they read everything through this lens of what does this tell us about the future. But that's not actually the way most Bible prophetic passages are meant to be read. And so rather than just focus on the what's in our future part, I took a broader view and said, let's cover everything in capsule form. Let's cover everything the Bible has to say about prophecy. And so I do cover what's in our future, but I also set it in a broader context and show you things about Bible prophecy and what the prophets said and who they were and how prophecy works that you wouldn't get in the books that are just focused on the future.
And it's not a prophecy, but I know a little bit about the future, that until the end of the year, till the last day of the year, you can get it for 20% off.
If you use the code WINTER at checkout at shop.catholic.com, I've heard that.
All books, CDs, DVDs, ebooks, tracks, MP3s on sale now, 20% off, right through the last day of the year, December 35th, I think that
Something like that.
Something like that. Just go to shop.catholic.com, take a look at all the great deals, including Bible Prophecy, the very latest hot off the presses publication from Catholic Answers that Jimmy just discussed. Who shall we go to? Anonymous in New Jersey listening on the Catholic Answers app. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hi, Jimmy. I just wanted to know your opinion on the Harry Potter series.
Uh-huh.
I've been listening to a number of exorcist conferences, and it seems as though there's a consensus of opinion among many exorcists that they are demonic.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know your opinion on it.
Well, I would say that in order to charge something with being demonic, you need to be careful. That's a loaded word. It's meant to scare people, and it has a legitimate use. Some things are genuinely demonic, and you need to avoid them because they'll expose you to demonic activity. For example, Satan worship. Satan worship is obviously demonic. You're worshiping a demon. You're worshiping the prince of demons. So that's bad. It's dangerous, and you don't want to do it. So Satanism is legitimately demonic, and therefore you want to avoid it. But if you aren't careful with how you use the word demonic, then you end up applying it in ways that actually aren't helpful. I mean, you could say, well, look, all sin comes into human experience because our first parents were deceived by the devil and they fell and we inherited original sin and the tendency to sin. And so in one way, all sin, in one way or another, all sin is demonic in some sense because sin entered the world through the agency of the devil. Well, okay then, eating one extra stick of bubble gum that you shouldn't have eaten is going to be demonic. Not a very helpful use of the word demonic, even though it's theologically defensible along the lines I just outlined. It's not a helpful use. My tendency is to use the word demonic only for things that directly involve demons. And the Harry Potter books do not directly involve demons. They have depictions of magic, but so does Lord of the Rings. So does the Chronicles of Narnia. Now, those magical practices are not morally legitimate in our world, but these are imaginary worlds. And imaginary worlds, because they're imaginary, don't have to obey the same laws that ours do. And so I would say that different people have different opinions about the moral and spiritual healthfulness of the Harry Potter books, and I think it's legitimate to debate that. I know some people think they're just fine, or at least just fine for most people. Now, obviously, if someone, let's say somebody has temptations towards Wiccanism,
mm-hmm.
well, then I'd say don't read the Harry Potter books because it's going to foster those temptations. But if somebody has no temptations toward Wiccanism, well, then they're not going to be put in the proximate occasion of sin by looking at this fictional universe any more than they would be by Lord of the Rings or Chronicles of Narnia. So so I would say it's legitimate to debate and discuss the moral and spiritual qualities of these books, but they don't directly involve demons, and so consequently, I don't find it helpful to refer to them as demonic. I think that is going to communicate a false impression of the books to an ordinary person.
How's that strike you, Anonymous?
It's helpful, yeah. So you would say that it's not helpful to categorize them as demonic or even spiritually dangerous.
Well, they are spiritually dangerous if you're tempted to Wiccanism, just like, you know, watching Star Trek can be spiritually dangerous if you're tempted towards some of the moral behavior Captain Kirk gets up to. You know, anything can be dangerous spiritually depending on your personal temptations. But are most people going to be tempted to go out and worship demons because they read Harry Potter? No. By the way, just for the record, I don't even like the Harry Potter books. I read the first one, and I don't think J.K. Rowling is a good author. But that's a different question. That's just my opinion. If you like them, fine. But it's also a different question than what's their moral spiritual value.
Anonymous, thank you very, very much for that call. I don't know why you picked on Captain Kirk. I mean, what about Spock? Some people are tempted to be like Spock,
uh-huh.
Like maybe even the Spock of Catholic apologetics or something.
I think Mr. Spock has many admirable qualities. I don't know what you're talking about.
I bet you do, Data. we go now to Elias in somewhere in California. Well, listening on Relevant Radio, 9:30 a.m. Elias, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, actually, an earlier caller talked about it, about the Holy Father and capital punishment. But I think in general my question would be, like, for our friends that have a tendency to fear just about everything the Holy Father does, our current Pope, what would be the best way to approach them to kind of calm their fears? Because it seems like it's like a huge part of even Catholic media now.
Yeah. And so it's a question that I actually devote a good bit of thought to, because one of the things that I view as one of my personal missions as an apologist is helping people understand and appreciate what the current Pope is doing and saying, no matter who that current Pope is. Obviously, at the moment, it's Pope Francis. But there have been, you know, challenges with John Paul II and with Benedict XVI and with any pope, where the media in particular is going to distort things that the Pope has said and done, and it can disturb people. They can find they lose their serenity. And one of my personal missions as an apologist is helping people retain their serenity amidst the turmoil of modern life. And so I, part of how I do it is by writing blog posts and going on radio shows to explain this stuff. But in terms of how I prep for that and how you can use the same principles, number one, following the advice of St. Paul, who says, reckon others better than yourselves, and following the advice of the Catechism, which says that we owe it to other people to give their statements the most charitable interpretation possible, start without a chip on your shoulder. Start by assuming goodwill and personal holiness on the part of the Pope, and by giving whatever he has said the most charitable interpretation you can. Recognize that the media doesn't always – it never reports the fullness of what the Pope says. And so go to the original sources and look them up. Don't just trust the media to get it right. And even in many statements the Pope makes, like in the course of a speech or in a media interview, he's not writing a book. He's expressing at most a partial truth. And so don't assume that what he's saying is meant to represent the totality of his thought on something. He has other thoughts, and you can presume that they're in line with church teaching. Do not have a hostile understanding or hermeneutic or interpretive principle that you're using when you look at papal statements. So those are sort of preparatory principles in terms of figuring out what the Pope has said and then how you can explain it to others. Checking, Orthodox Catholic blogs, like I would say mine, or what you find at Catholic.com or what you find at the National Catholic Register, those can be helpful to get perspective on things the Pope has said recently. In terms of directly talking to people, who are disturbed by things, I would say, tell them, look, number one, chill out. God's in control. It's ultimately God's responsibility to shepherd the church and to deal with its shepherds. And he gives them guidance and assistance by the Holy Spirit. Over the course of time, now that may result in a somewhat bumpy historical process as God guides the church, but he does guide the church. So have faith and recognize that even though we may have temporary bumps in the road, in the long term, the Holy Spirit is guiding us into all truth. And so be open and be respectful and be prayerful. And as Jesus said, you can't even make one hair of your head white or black by worrying. So trust God, focus on what you need to do, and leave the rest in God's hands.
Elias, thank you very much for that call. We have to go to a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
It could be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows you how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never really seemed to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I met my husband in my first year of college. We both came from strong Catholic families and wanted lots of children. After 3 years of marriage and still not pregnant, we felt our dream of a big family slipping away. My sister encouraged us to visit our local Catholic store and get a novena to St. Gerard. When we arrived, we were unsure about our need, but the staff was kind and helpful. Wow, what an incredible Catholic store! They encouraged us to pray and trust in God's providence. One worker told us stories of other couples, just like us, who were desperate to start a family. 4 years and two children later, we have been back to that incredible Catholic store for baby, baptism, and toddler gifts. God bless the staff at that incredible Catholic store. An incredible Catholic store in your area can be found at incrediblecatholicstore.com. The Incredible Catholic Store, transforming the world one soul at a time.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum, any question you have about the Catholic faith, Catholic history, Catholic life, Catholic moral teaching, any of it, it's all up for grabs. We're happy to take your question. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Anyone is welcome to call. And if you're on the line and you feel like, I'm not going to make it, don't worry. We got a whole hour after this, more of Catholic Answers Open Forum. Mark Brumley will be here.
A
friend of yours, Mark Brumley.
Yes, and a very, very competent apologist.
Yes, very much so. And a fun guy to hang around with, too. He's the president of Ignatius Press. I say that he's a fun guy to hang around with just to make it seem like I'm palsy with a super important person like Mark. Oh. I'm just trying to make myself
Mark would be happy to hang out with you.
Well, he doesn't seem like it when he's actually around. No, that's not true. Daniel in Maine, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Lots of people listening on the Catholic Answers app today. That makes me very happy. We'd love you to have the app. Just go download it for your phone, and I think you'll be happy you have it. Daniel, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. My family and I are Protestant, and I really want to become a Catholic, mm-hmm. but my parents are highly against it. Mm-hmm. So I know in the Bible it says honor your mother and father. So how do I become Catholic while still honoring them?
Daniel, what age are you?
I'm 20.
You're 20. Okay, so you're a legal adult. You may be. Are you still living with your parents?
I'm living on campus at my college.
Okay. But you're not living under their roof.
No, but they pay for a lot of stuff from me.
Okay.
Like medical stuff and everything.
Okay. So you're at a transitional time of life, and that complicates things a little bit. But ultimately, I mean, you are a legal adult, and from a Catholic point of view, you're an adult in the canonical sense, meaning under the code of canon law, you're an adult, and you can make your own decisions in this matter. I don't say that to take anything away from the sensitivities that I know are involved in this question, but just as a point of fact, you're a legal adult, and so you can make your own decisions. In terms of honoring your father and mother, honoring your father and mother means different things at different times of life. When you're a child and you aren't able, like let's say you're 6 years old, you don't have an adult's use of reason, and so you're obliged to listen to what your parents say to do and to do it. So at that age, honoring your father and mother implies not just showing them respect, but also giving them obedience. As you grow, though, and become a normal functional adult, the way you honor your father and mother shifts so that it does no longer involves owing them obedience, but showing them respect. Also, it can involve, especially in transitional times, taking very seriously their counsel, because even though you may not be obliged to obey them anymore, they still have a lot of life experience that you don't, and maturity and so forth that one is still growing in, and you can benefit from taking their advice very seriously, assuming they're normal, healthy, mature people of sound judgment. So I would say that you're at your stage in life, you're not obliged to obey them in the sense of not becoming Catholic. You're free to do that, and God's placed it in your heart to do that. And so I would do that. To me, the question would be the timing. On the one hand, you recognize the truth now, and it makes sense, all things being equal, to act now, to go ahead and become Catholic. And that coming in will be a process. Under most circumstances, the soonest you'd come in would likely be next Easter. But you're certainly free to do that. It can raise sensitivities with your family. You know how strong those sensitivities would be better than I do. And you know better than I do how to best navigate those family situations and what the consequences would be. But I would say you've recognized the truth of the Catholic faith, so make it your goal to become Catholic. The question is not whether to become Catholic, but when and how to best manage that transition with respect to your family. And so I would say, talk to a local priest. Find ways of continuing to demonstrate to your family that you love them and that you care about them, and that may or may not mean talking about this with them. Sometimes talking about a situation like this can inflame it, and it may be best to just say, Mom and Dad, I love you. I feel like I need to do this, and my conscience requires me to do this, so I am going to do it, but I still love and care about you guys, and I want to make sure you know that.
Daniel?
Yeah.
How does that strike you?
I had a follow-up question, if you have time. If not, then that's okay.
Sure. What's your follow-up question?
I don't want to cause conflict with them because the first time that I went to Mass, I simply asked my dad, because I visited a few Catholic churches, I asked my dad, how are you today? And he said, you know my opinion of you going to the Catholic Church, and it was very angry.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just asking how he was, so that's the tension.
Right. Well, that's indicative of a significant amount of tension.
Daniel, you give us a call back anytime. We'd like to continue this conversation with you. You're always welcome here. You will certainly be in our prayers. I hope that what Jimmy has said has been helpful to you today. 888-31-TRUTH is our number for those who have a question for Jimmy or next hour for Mark Brumley. I'm going to move on just because there are lots of folks trying to get through. We go to Susan in Downington, Pennsylvania, listening on Holy Spirit Radio. Susan, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, I was listening to a Catholic priest. It was a video that was put out, and he was talking about ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that people only go to one of three places, heaven, purgatory, or hell. But he said sometimes they can manifest themselves on earth to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what we see is either demonic or it's a soul from purgatory trying to communicate to the people to ask for prayers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just wanted to know is that something that the Catholic Church teaches,
okay,
or is it something that he just supposed?
Properly speaking, the Catholic Church teaches that there are only two ultimate destinies, heaven and hell. Purgatory is a transitional state where someone who is ultimately going to heaven is being purified so that they're capable of the full glory of heaven. So properly speaking, there are only two ultimate destinies, heaven and hell, and purgatory is a transitional state on your way to heaven. In terms of reported, it's true that God does allow people who are in the next life sometimes to manifest to people who are in this life. We know that's the case, for example, with private apparitions of the saints in heaven. So God does let people who are in heaven manifest to people who are on earth. That's something the church does teach. In terms of people who are in purgatory, it is not church teaching that God sometimes allows them to manifest here on earth, but it is a widely reported phenomenon in church history, and it's not contrary to church teaching. So I take it seriously that someone who's in purgatory may be able to manifest to, for example, ask for or encourage prayers on their behalf. I don't dismiss that as a possibility at all. It's not church teaching, but it's a respected theological opinion and a widely reported phenomenon. In terms of reports of ghostly phenomena and what they may be, there's kind of a spectrum that includes some other options. I mean, it could be an apparition, could be a soul in purgatory, could be a demon, could be somebody's imagination, could be a loose cable that's bumping stuff when it gets blown by the wind. So there's a big range of possibilities.
Susan, thanks very much for that call. Those of you who are on the line, please stay on the line. Mark Brumley will be here shortly to take your calls. If you're not on the line, but you have a question for us for Open Forum, 888-31-TRUTH is our number. Jimmy Akin, thank you for another fine hour.
Likewise, Cyrus Kellett.
And Cyril.
Cyril Kellett. Oh, sorry, there we go.
Cyrus the Great, though. I'll take that.
Okay.
Bible Prophecy is the newest book from Jimmy Akin, one of the Catholic Answers, 20 Answers books. You can get it at shop.catholic.com, where everything is 20% off until the end of the year. We'll see you right after this, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.